Hi there, dolls, music lovers, and fashion enthusiasts. Welcome to Unveiling the Legends, Dolls of the 60s and 70s, the podcast that takes you on a groovy journey through the lives and legacies of the incredible women who shaped these iconic decades. We are your hosts, Emma
and Abby,
and together we'll explore the stories behind the music, the fashion, and the cultural revolution that defined an era.
Each episode will shine a spotlight on a remarkable woman, from rock and roll rebels to fashion icons, and dive into their impact on the world. We'll also uncover the historical context and celebrate the lasting influence of these trailblazing ladies. So, grab your bell bottoms and get ready to rock and roll as we uncover the untold stories of dolls who left their mark. Let's dive in.
How have you been? Any more breakdown fridges? Any more
no more
horrible things?
Appliances.
Or was it good? I'm so
Bless.
Happy to hear that.
I actually had a somewhat nice weekend.
Oh, that's good.
I went to a sunflower maze.
Oh, wow. Oh, that's so beautiful.
They only have it for about, I'd say, 3 or 4 weekends until the sunflowers are out of season. But it was pick your own. I have my bouquet over there.
Oh, that's so pretty.
They give you a little pair of garden shears and you just go in, pick what you want,
so
and then you
sweet.
Pay at the end. It was great. And then I got maybe the biggest ice cream sundae I've ever had in my life. I didn't know what I was getting myself into. I just saw that it was $8. And I thought it was $8 because it had blueberry pie filling in
it. That sounds pretty good.
And like a piece of pie crust. And it was this ice cream here called a maple creamy because it's made with maple syrup. It's this special regional thing.
Sounds really good.
Kind of known for it out here. It's so good. It's so good, Emma. It's vanilla with just the slightest hint of maple.
That sounds brilliant.
And then in the sundae, I had all this blueberry pie stuff on it, but it was seriously this big. I couldn't finish
That's
it.
That's crazy, though.
As soon as the girl handed it to me through the window, I was like, ah, what have I done?
Oh, that's so much fun, though. And you finished this season of Vinyl Monday, and I'm so proud of you.
Oh, just barely. I was up until 1 o'clock in the morning getting everything in order because I lost so much time going to the sunflower maze.
It was worth it.
And then I get dragged to an apple orchard too, and you got to do the fun stuff at the apple orchard. You got to get the cider and the donuts. So I lost about 4 hours. I'm so glad it's done, and I'm really happy with how this season went.
Oh, it was
overall.
Great. I really enjoyed it.
Thank you.
As someone who's watched every episode, I can say it was a great season.
I have my personal highlights. What were yours?
I have to say, I really enjoyed your modern records.
Ah.
Because that's something I don't really, like, this might sound weird, but I didn't know a lot of the bands, actually. This is, like, not my type of music at all. But I really enjoyed learning about it. For me, my personal favorite was the Layla. I could see how much work you put into it.
It was I always say the finales are a labor of love.
Yeah.
I had to put everything I had into that record. 2 years ago, I did it the first time, and I was almost there. I just felt ready for the challenge now. And I'm so glad that you love the modern record series, because I go so hard for that series, even if compared to the other episodes, they don't get a lot of attention. But it's important for a classic rock channel to acknowledge how far-reaching, you know, the scope of my usual material is. Like, we wouldn't have the Strokes if we didn't have the Ramones. We wouldn't have, gosh, like, Leonard Cohen influencing Lana Del Rey. People don't think about that. And, of course, we wouldn't have Amy Winehouse's Back to Black if we did not have today's doll. I apologize in advance for any construction noises. They're moving dirt around. For this episode, I think it's best to start with a song. What you just heard was an excerpt from Be My Baby. I was 15 years old when I started making monthly favorites playlists to listen to while I did my hair and makeup. My home base now is firmly in the late 60s and early 70s counterculture bands, but in high school, I went through a big late 50s and early 60s pop music phase. Every day as I got ready for school, I'd listen to Frankie Valli and the Four Seasons, Paul Anka, The Crystals, The Chiffons, and of course, The Fabulous Ronettes, fronted by today's doll, Ronnie Spector. My two main resources for this episode are Laura Flam and Emily Sue Leibowitz's But Will You Still Love Me Tomorrow? An Oral History of the 60s Girl Groups. My best friend Jack gave me access to this. He literally just got his copy in. This is a pretty new book. We cannot recommend this enough. It's like Please Kill Me, but for girl groups. So if you're into the Chiffons and, you know, Darlene Love, the Shangri-Las, this is a must for you. The other was Ronnie's autobiography, Be My Baby, How I Survived Mascara, Miniskirts, and Madness, or My Life as a Fabulous Ronette. Firstly, that is maybe the longest title of a book I've ever read, but Mascara, Miniskirts, and Madness is too perfect not to mention. Ronnie's story is just as much about being a rock and roll chick as it is a story of surviving some really disturbing things. Ronnie wrote her book to serve as a warning and to raise awareness on domestic abuse. If that's a sensitive topic for you, then this is not the episode for you. Domestic abuse is a big theme in our story today. Please take care of yourselves. We'll see you for the next episode. But if you're ready to hear a truly remarkable story, take it away, Emma.
Veronica Yvette Bennett was born on August 10th in 1943 in Spanish Harlem in New York, better known today as Washington Heights. Her mother, Beatrice Mobley, was Black and Cherokee. Her father, Louis, a subway worker, was white. Older sister and future Ronette, Estelle, was born in 1941. It seems Ronnie was born with music in her veins and the need to be the star of the show. Her friend Lala Brooks said, in quotes, "Ronnie loves attention. She'd sing to a pineapple." As the story goes, when she was just 16 months old, she sang for people on the subway. Growing up, Ronnie and her sister learned the world wasn't as accepting as their neighborhood. Spanish Harlem was a beautiful, eclectic place in the 1940s and 50s. Black, white, Asian, and Latin people coexisted, and interracial marriage was fairly normalized. Labels like immigrant didn't matter here. Here, everybody was a New Yorker. But being Black, white, and Cherokee, Ronnie didn't feel as though she fit in anywhere. She was bullied at school for looking different from the other kids. She was too Black to play with the white girls, too white to play with the Black girls, and the Spanish girls wouldn't play with her because she couldn't speak Spanish. So Ronnie mostly played with relatives at her grandmother's house. She grew especially close to her younger cousin, Nedra Talley. Every weekend, the Bennett Mobley Talley crew would flock on the matriarch's house, filling it with dancing, music, and laughter.
Music and family were Ronnie's escape from tough times at school. Lewis was a drummer. Harlem in the 1950s was the mecca of jazz. Thelonious Monk, Sonny Rollins, Dizzy Gillespie, and Charlie Mingus were all on the circuit at the time. Lewis's dream was to play all the hottest clubs with them. Though Lewis never achieved this dream, he passed on his love of music to his daughters. Lewis and Beatrice nurtured their daughters' natural talent as best they could, though money was tight. Since they could only afford to enroll one of the girls in dance lessons, they chose Estelle since she was older. What did Ronnie do? She'd hang around at the studio, watch the classes through the window, and teach herself the choreography. Ronnie, Estelle, and Nedra became the star attraction of the family weekends. The grown-ups even set up a little stage at Grandma's house for the girls to perform on. No one in the family were professional musicians, but the girls picked up on music from their aunts and uncles' natural talent. They learned to harmonize from hearing the grown-ups sing together. But things weren't all sunshine and roses for the Bennetts. The girls were too young to understand that Lewis was depressed and used alcohol to cope. The family were always in such dire straits because he would drink what little money they had away. Lewis and Beatrice did their best to hide their marital problems, only arguing when they thought their daughters were asleep. By the time Estelle and Ronnie were in junior high, it was getting harder for their mom to hide Dad's problem. He'd stumble home early in the morning and pass out drunk. When Ronnie was 12, her mom had had enough, and the Bennetts divorced. Beatrice got a job waitressing to support herself and the girls.
Junior high was a tough time for Ronnie, not just because her parents split up. Girls are so mean at that age. The bullying gave Ronnie an identity crisis. She'd sit in front of the mirror for ages, picking her appearance apart. In quotes, "I've got white eyes, but these are black lips." Her long, dark, straight hair came from her mom's Cherokee lineage, and her skin was lighter than her black cousins. Ronnie got to feeling like she didn't fit in within her own family anymore. She longed to look like them, with dark skin and coarse, curly hair. So one day, Ronnie went to the store and bought self-tanning lotion, but she fell asleep before washing it off. When she woke up from her nap, she was horrified to find the lotion had stained her skin in dark stripes.
Oh no.
I feel so bad for her.
When you were at that age, you know, 12, 13, did you ever have just any fails like that? Because I absolutely did.
Oh yeah.
You know, you dye your hair expecting it to be one color and then it turns out the color of raw chicken or something like that.
Yeah. Or you do your makeup and you think it looks really good and it clearly doesn't and everyone's too polite to tell you and you look back at pictures and you're like, why did I ever leave the house like
mm-hmm,
this?
Mm-hmm. I had Sharpie brows.
Oh, that's fine.
That's fine. But there's another layer of complexity for that for Ronnie because
yes,
she was always considered, you know, too black to be white and too white to be black. So she just did that because she wanted to be darker and fit in.
I feel so bad for her because you usually think that at least in your family, you would have the feel of fitting in.
Mm.
I mean, she is a truly beautiful yes. woman. She really yes. is. And it pains me that she thought she wasn't good enough. Once again, music was Ronnie's escape. You see, the restaurant her mom worked at was across from the famous Apollo Theater on West 125th Street. Ronnie and Estelle were fascinated by the theater's bright lights and big crowds lined up around the block. Every day after school, the girls hung out around the restaurant, eagerly waiting at the window in hopes of seeing a pop star. Would they see glamorous Ella Fitzgerald or the wild James Brown pull up in their big black limousines? What if one day the girls pulled up in their own shiny car? The Apollo was the place of dreams. In early 1956, when Ronnie was 12, Frankie Lyman and the teenagers released their hit single, Why Do Fools Fall in Love? It was the ultimate teen anthem, a peppy song about the angst of young love. It was a major hit, peaking at number 7 on the Billboard Hot 100 singles charts. Like so many young girls at the time, when Ronnie first heard the song, she was instantly hooked. Frankie became her first crush. She loved his voice so much that she'd press her ear right up against the speaker when the song came on the radio.
Aww.
Her grandma would have to pull her away and scold her, saying she'd go deaf if she kept doing that. I used to do that too.
Aww.
But Ronnie didn't care. She swore up and down that she'd meet Frankie someday. Miraculously, she did. One day, Beatrice was talking to her coworker about her daughter's big fat crush on Frankie Lyman, who walked into the restaurant but Frankie Lyman himself. Ronnie wasn't out of school yet, so it was Beatrice who invited Frankie to her daughter's 13th birthday party. When he didn't show up, Ronnie was devastated.
Aww.
She cried all night, but Frankie's brothers came. They must have told him how pretty Ronnie was. After school one day, she came home to the shock of her life. Frankie Lyman waiting for her there. But their meeting wasn't all she'd hoped for. When he leaned in to kiss her, Ronnie could smell alcohol in his breath. Things were so awkward that Ronnie locked herself in the bathroom until he left. Despite how disappointing the interaction was, Ronnie still loved Frankie's music. She still wanted to make a record just like Why Do Fools Fall in Love. She found other groups to love just as much as the teenagers, namely the girl group The Chantelles.
One day, a man wandered into the restaurant Ronnie's mom worked at. Once again, Beatrice bragged about how beautiful and talented her daughters were, and it did them well. Turns out this man's family owned the Apollo Theater. This chance meeting got Estelle, Ronnie, and their cousins a spot in Apollo's amateur night. When Ronnie heard the news, she was ecstatic. Her and her cousins quickly got to work arranging their own version of Why Do Fools Fall in Love. The girls sang harmony while the boy sang lead, but when the night came, they all shuffled on stage and the music started. He had stage fright and forgot all the words. Oh. Of course, since Ronnie was a Frankie Lyman superfan and knew all the words to all his songs, she took over. The crowd ate it up, cheering and clapping through the whole song. Despite the bump in the road, that first night at the Apollo was a dream come true for Ronnie. It was her first taste of a real stage, and she was hooked. As she entered high school, she had her sights set on stardom. There was no other future for her. High school was a little easier for Estelle and Ronnie. The girls attended George Washington High School in Washington Heights, where Estelle graduated as valedictorian of her class. As soon as she was old enough, Ronnie got an after-school job so she'd have the money for clothes and makeup. All the while, the sisters plus Nedra formed their own group. Per Grandma's suggestion, they named themselves the Darling Sisters. At last, Ronnie was a working musician, though singing at school dances and bar mitzvahs was a lot less glamorous than the Apollo Theater. The girls put together their own arrangements of rock and roll songs, with Ronnie singing lead and Estelle and Nedra on harmony. In 1961, the Darling Sisters changed their name to Ronnie and the Relatives. This was the name they cut their first singles under. The girls landed an opportunity to audition for Stu Phillips. They recorded 4 songs, 2 singles, in this one session. Even though all their aunts and uncles bought the singles when they came out, both flopped. The Ronnie and the Relatives name just didn't have the ring to it.
I kind of get that. Ronnie and the Relatives, if I wouldn't know that these were 3 young girls, this kind of sounds like 40-year-old middle-aged men. I don't know, it doesn't seem like a girl group.
Yeah, it could be, I'm envisioning a barbershop quartet right now.
Something like that. The girls refused to give up. In hopes of being spotted by a talent agent, they started hanging around the Peppermint Lounge, though they were way too young to get in. Ronnie was 17 and still in high school. Nedra was only 15. Estelle had a job at the Macy's makeup counter, so she made them all up to look old enough to get in. They applied matching dark eyeliner and pale lipstick. They did their hair up as big as they could, wore the tightest dresses they could squeeze into, they even stuffed their bras. And somehow it worked. Ronnie, Estelle, and Nedra wanted to be seen, and seen they were. When the bouncer spotted the girls in line in their matching hairdos, he assumed they were famous and let them in. They even had the manager fooled. He assumed the Relatives were the entertainment that night. This opportunity was way too good to pass up, so the girls jumped on stage with the house band and did a little dance routine. When they started playing What I Say, Ronnie knew it was her time to shine. The singer passed her the microphone, and in minutes, the Peppermint Lounge manager hired the Relatives. Every night until closing time, they dance on the stage with the house band Joey D and the Starlighters. Inspired by the Babettes and Marvelettes, the girls wanted to change their name. They first considered the Mobilettes after Beatrice made a name Mobley. About the name they chose, Nedra said, in quotes, "You gotta understand Ronnie's personality. Ronnie did need to be that person that was very out front." They changed to the Rondettes, Ro for Ronnie, Ned for Nedra, and E for Estelle. After the name was mispronounced so many times, they dropped the D and became the Fabulous Ronettes. I think that's such a sweet story. They really faked it till they made it.
Yes.
And I really love that. I love that these girls were so young but knew what they wanted and had all that confidence to do it. Mm-hmm. I think that's really remarkable.
They had tenacity. That's what they
had. Yeah, they really did. They knew what they wanted and they knew how to get it.
Gosh, did you ever do that when you were a teenager? Just try to look old enough for the job and then try and get in somewhere?
One time, my dad had like tickets to this magic show. My dad's a magician and like he knows all the other magicians.
This is like my new favorite piece of the podcast lore. Emma's dad is a magician.
Yeah, it's fun. But he had these cards left for this very cool magic show, basically, that we really wanted to attend. Me being my best friend and I, we were like 14 or 15 at the time. And we knew that this was like obviously an event for grown-ups. And we knew they would most likely check IDs. So we like got dresses from her mom and like got very, very ready. And then you will not believe this. We got in, everything went fine. And then on the way home, someone got into the subway and wanted to check our tickets. Oh. And back then we had these like student ID tickets because we were still in school. And that man didn't believe it was us. He, like, started such a huge argument and fight that, like, eventually his colleague had to come and be like, okay, if this is right, I don't know, I don't care, we can just let them go. It was so ridiculous, and I couldn't believe that we fumbled them. That was so much fun, though.
It just amazes me that people can get into things so easily. I'm 25, and I still get carded at places. And I think it's the hair.
It might be. I don't know. I also think it's the frilly dresses for me.
Mm-hmm.
It depends where you go. Because clubs and, like, bars here aren't even that strict. Because, like, the whole policy on alcohol is a lot more looser in Germany.
Mm-hmm.
But for some reason, some cinemas are so strict. And whenever
really?
I see a movie that's, like, 16 and older or 18 mm-hmm. and older, I have to show my ID. Every single time.
Movies. That's amazing.
That's
they just let
wild.
Anybody to anything over here. They don't even
yeah,
check your
so
bags, so you can just bring in whatever food you want. You don't have to pay for concession. My best friend from high school and I, our local movie theater when we were in school, it was right next to an Italian bakery.
That sounds perfect.
So what we would do is we would go to the bakery. We would get a box of Italian wedding cookies.
Oh, that sounds so
good. We
would
stick them in our backpacks. We would go into the movies. And we just eat them the whole
That's
way through.
That's great, honestly.
The Ronettes got into the Peppermint Lounge, and I can't even buy a nip without getting ID'd.
Oh, man. That same year, 1961, Joey D and the Starlighters were cast in the movie Hey, Let's Twist. The Peppermint Lounge was the birthplace of the twist dance craze, so it was only natural they were part of it. Joey and the guys loved playing with the Ronettes so much that they tried to get them roles in the movie. But when the casting director came around to check out the Ronettes act, he turned them down. According to him, they were too light-skinned to play black girls and too black to be white girls. This bugs me so mm-hmm. bad, because we all know that racism is a thing. The fact that you want to make a movie about a place and the dance that originated there, and you don't want to make it with the people who originated it there because that doesn't fit your stereotype
mm-hmm.
is so messed up to me.
It bugs me. They cast white girls to play the Starlighter's girlfriends, by the way.
The Ronettes did get to be in the movie, they can be seen in the crowd of a dance scene, and supported the Starlighters all through filming. But they were heartbroken over the rejection. I can imagine.
Mm-hmm. When they went to, I don't think it was an opening night, but they did go to see Hey, Let's Twist in the theaters, and all of the mm-hmm. kids there were laughing and having so much fun. And Ronnie said something to the effect of, we were the only girls in New York who cried all the way through Hey, Let's Twist.
Oh, that's so sad.
Because, you know, when you're that age and you don't get something that you really, really, yeah. really want, it just breaks your heart.
It does. You often don't have the perspective that one day it all won't be that bad.
Mm-hmm.
Teenage pain is so big and it is so mm-hmm. real.
At the same time as the Peppermint Lounge's twisting heyday, Murray the K put on his live shows at the Fox Theater in Brooklyn. In the late 60s, Murray was responsible for both Cream and The Who's U.S. debuts. He platformed The Temptations and a pre-Motown Stevie Wonder as well. Every time the Ronettes bumped into Stevie, he'd tell the girls how great they looked. Though Stevie obviously couldn't see it and he was just being funny with the girls, they really did look great.
They did.
In 1962, Murray would be responsible for the Ronettes hitting it big. In the spring, they landed a gig as backup singers. Eventually, they got to sing a song or two of their own. Like Rita Coolidge a couple episodes ago, they also recorded bumpers for Murray's radio station. They added iconic venues like the Café Wa to their rotation. The Ronettes built a strong local fan base of mostly gay men and women. But they weren't satisfied with just being a local attraction. After things fell apart with Stu Phillips, they started looking for another songwriter and producer. By 1963, the top producer in American pop music was Phil Spector. He will play a very big role in today's story. But right now, he's recorded big names like Connie Francis and Darlene Love. He also arranged and recorded The Crystals' He Hit Me and It Felt Like a Kiss. Written by Jerry Goffin and Carol King, He Hit Me caused just as much controversy as it was a major hit, despite the song's content, excusing away domestic violence under the guise of love. It's part of the 60s girl group canon.
He hit me, and it felt
Juliet's new Phil Spector had the power to make girl groups into superstars, so Estelle boldly called his studio and asked the secretary if she could talk to him. To their surprise, she said yes, and to even more of a shock, Phil already knew who the Ronettes were. He was a regular at the Fox Theater. To say the absolute least, Phil was a strange man. But at this point in his career, his cold personality and fiery temper were written off as the quirks of a genius. Phil pulled out all the stops for the Ronettes when they first met. He played piano for them and took them out to eat in his fancy limousine. Phil first tried to sign Ronnie as a solo artist, but Beatrice, serving as momager of sorts, said no. The Ronettes were a package deal. If he wanted Ronnie, he had to sign Nedra and Estelle too. In March of 1963, the Ronettes were signed to Phil's Records, real creative name, and Phil instantly became fixated on Ronnie. Surprisingly, she kind of liked him at first. Phil was short and already losing his hair, but she, quote, fell in love with his coolness, as she said in But Will You Love Me Tomorrow. Quote, he was very cool. Always had one hand in his pocket, and he had a cute butt. The way he handled the band, here's a guy, 24 years old, yet he's telling married men with children what to do? That turned me on so much. I fell in love with his power. She was dazzled by that very power over people, and he held that very power over her. Remember, Ronnie was a minor at the time. Yes. As we'll see very soon, Phil completely love-bombed her.
In 1963, Phil brought the Ronettes to California, where they were to record their next single. It was their first cross-country flight. The song in question was Be My Baby. The girls were dazzled by the recording process in a fancy LA studio with an orchestra, tons of musicians, and engineers running around. Phil loved having lots and lots of backup singers on his records. If you were hanging around Gold Star Studio and you could carry a tune, you'd probably be roped into singing on a Phil song. And this is exactly what happened to Cher. If you listen really hard, you might hear her sing in the chorus through Ronnie's verses. At 17 years old, it was the first record she ever sang on, in quotes. I'd never seen anybody like her, she said of meeting Ronnie. She had this big hair, these huge eyes, and no hips. I remember thinking that she seemed really, really teeny. And that voice, well, nobody sounded like her, did they? The two immediately hit it off. They both loved singing and makeup and knew how it felt to be an outsider. This recording session forged a lifelong friendship. Cher even wrote the foreword for Ronnie's book, with both women coming from careers controlled by older partners. Since they were very young, they shared a truly special bond. In late August, Be My Baby took pop radio by storm. The girls were thrilled with their success. The Ronettes were on tour, Ronnie remembers, of the first time she heard her own song, in quotes. We were lying in a bed watching Dick Clark's American Bandstand when he said, this is going to be the record of the century. The girls freaked out, squealing and hugging each other like excited teenage girls, in quotes. And it was the record of the century. Be My Baby peaked at number 2 on the Billboard Hot 100 single charts. The Ronettes were an overnight sensation. The song is utterly timeless. In the introduction Billy Joel wrote for Ronnie's book, he remembered how parties always jolted to life when the song came on. Billy claims that if the song were recorded and released today, it'd still be a hit.
I don't think I'd want it recorded today. There's that certain something about those early 60s hits that modern music production just can't capture. If there's anything you gotta give to Phil Spector, it's that he was a brilliant producer.
Yeah, he was.
You just can't replicate now what he did then.
Yeah.
But I think we both agree Be My Baby has stood the test of time fabulously.
It really did. I actually thought about this when you brought it up. Be My Baby is a song that often also comes up on like trending TikTok pages all of the sudden.
Yeah.
I mean, I see it's getting used by a lot of people who usually aren't into the 60s and 70s, but there's something about this song that is so nostalgic yet timeless. Mm-hmm. It's just the perfect blend.
Yeah.
It's one of the most influential songs of the whole 1960s, particularly on Brian Wilson of the Beach Boys. There's an entire section of the song's Wikipedia page about its effect on Brian. It drove him to become just as amazing a producer as Phil Spector, and drove his family up the wall when he played it over and over again. Mm-hmm. He loved Phil Spector's wall of sound, as he would call it, and Ronnie's unique and powerful voice. I used to do that too. I am very much the
play
person
something
who
over yes. and over. Mm-hmm.
At one point, my mom, she like got me headphones and she was like, "This is it. You're not playing this one more time out in your room. I cannot hear it one more time." Until then, girl groups were styled as glamorous, sophisticated women. They wore glittering dresses and furs on stage and did their demure and mindful choreography.
I'm sorry, I couldn't help myself. Very demure.
I have to say,
mindful.
As someone who didn't grow up mm-hmm. speaking English, demure is a word I learned last week from TikTok. And I had no idea. Oh. The Ronettes were different. They had the appeal of bad girls who sat in the back of the classroom chewing gum, or the girls who smoked cigarettes behind the bleachers. The Ronettes felt enough like real girls to relate to teens. Girls all over America were emulating Ronnie and her signature bad girl style. But the Ronettes were glamorous enough to be embraced by adults too. They owned their sexuality, cutting slits in their dresses and flirting with cute boys in the audience. The girls' family got a little weird after they got famous. So did their classmates at school. But Louis was ecstatic. He attended every single Ronette show he could. Mm-hmm. He was so proud of his niece and baby girls for living the dream he never could. Sadly, Frankie Lyman got weird about Ronnie's success too. He was no longer the fresh-faced teenager of the teenager's days. Now he was 20 years old, a washed-up alcoholic with bad skin. The two met again after Be My Baby blew up, with Frankie completely fanboying over the song. Ronnie was flattered, but things quickly turned when he tried to come on to her. She had to call security to throw him out of the theater.
Frankie really struggled with alcoholism through his career, starting from really, really young.
Yeah, it's another career kind of taken by alcohol. Mm-hmm. Who knows? I feel like he was a fabulous musician and he had something truly special to him. And I wish we could have seen where his career could have went.
Yeah, and he resonated with Ronnie so much because she said in her book that she didn't know if he was black or white. She just knew he had an amazing voice. And that was Ronnie's appeal with the American public in the early 1960s.
Yeah, she kind of like got over the needing to fit in thing.
Mm-hmm.
And they were just Ronnie and the Ronettes, and that was it.
Those girls broke down barriers.
Yeah, they did.
Between teens and adults, black and white, high culture and pop culture, they were it. 1963 into 64 belonged to the Ronettes. Baby, I Love You, Do I Love You, The Best Part of Breaking Up, Walking in the Rain, and their sassy renditions of Sleigh Ride and Frosty the Snowman were all hits. In November of that year, they released their one and only album, Presenting the Fabulous Ronettes, featuring Veronica. Again, she had to be the one out front. At last, her dream had come true. Darlene Love of the Blossoms, who were close friends with the Ronettes at the height of their fame, said, quote, "I don't think anybody really wanted success like Ronnie did. When the girls got their first royalty checks, Ronnie panicked and gave hers to her mom for safekeeping. She was so young and had never had that much money before. I remember the feeling of first getting paid for my first. Yeah. I didn't know what to do. I just like put the money away. I'm not gonna touch it.
I thought I would save all my money. Mm-hmm. And then at one point I realized, oh, but you have to pay for certain things like a flat. Mm-hmm. Or food, or I don't know, there are necessities in life. But the first paycheck, no matter how high or low it is, it makes you feel very rich.
Mm-hmm.
And it also makes you feel really proud and accomplished because it's like the first time you get your work paid. And that's just such a special thing.
Phil kept treating the girls to meals, kind of. Since he, quote, only had $100 bills in his wallet, he'd have the girls pay for him instead, promising he'd pay them back later. Surprise, surprise, he never did. By 1964, the Ronettes were big enough to tour Europe. They quickly had hordes of fans, including the likes of the Beatles and the Rolling Stones. A month before the Beatles' landmark appearance on the Ed Sullivan Show, they met the Ronettes at a party. Ronnie really hit it off with John Lennon. She thought he was so funny and smart. They even shared a kiss. But after a few double dates with George Harrison and Estelle, Ronnie turned John down for Phil. Besides, John was married. The Rolling Stones were just as big of fans, even opening for the Ronettes on tour. One can imagine the Glimmer Twins fighting over Ronnie. But Phil caught wind of the girls' little rendezvous with the Beatles. He axed the Beatles' Ronettes' joint flight back to America, which would have been great publicity for the girls. Yes, that flight, with all the news footage, yes, and all the girls like screaming out front and the photos. It was that deplaning.
This is actually how I learned about the Ronettes. Like, besides their music, this is how I first got a picture of them, because I read in a Beatles biography about this, and I was so weirded out by the fact that their producer didn't want what was best for both bands that I, like, decided to dug deeper and came across this whole Phil Spector bubble, or whatever you want to call it.
You opened the can of worms.
Yes.
Instead, Phil put himself on that plane with the Beatles.
Of course.
He just wanted to be famous.
Yeah.
Then he told the Stones if they wanted to keep their job as opening act, they were forbidden from hanging out with the Ronettes. But once the rebellious trio found out about Phil's telegram, Ronnie sent her own inviting the boys to Nedra's birthday.
I love this.
The Stones turned up with a birthday cake, and bad boy Keith Richards won Ronnie's affection. In his own book, Life, Keith remembers him and Mick hiding out in Beatrice's place with Ronnie and Estelle. No one in Spanish Harlem really cared about the British bands at the time, so the Stones could fly under the radar. About one of the most famous bands in the world crashing at her mom's house, Ronnie said, quote, "They slept on the floor, not in my bed. My mother would, every morning, 'You want some bacon and eggs?' And they were so polite. They even went on a double date, Keith and Ronnie, Mick and Estelle, to see James Brown. But once again, Ronnie felt guilty and chose Phil over Keith."
Ah, man. I mean, I kind of get why she always went back to Phil.
But you know, you're young and you do what you want to do and you do what you think is right. And it gets you in sticky situations.
Yeah.
The mess sounding the Ronettes, Beatles, and Stones was just the tip of the iceberg of Phil's controlling behavior. For example, he would fly Ronnie places while the other girls had to drive. The group lunches and dinners became intimate candlelit dinners. He'd keep her at rehearsal late for private singing lessons. He didn't like going out, so he made Ronnie stay in, and he intentionally kept her too busy to attend family events. Phil was obsessed with her. He'd stop at nothing to have him all to herself. So they began dating. Early in their relationship, Ronnie discovered women's shoes all over the floor of Phil's closet. He walked in on her and scolded her for snooping in his things. The shoes belonged to his wife, Annette, of the Spectres 3. That's right. Phil targeted the lead singer of a previous trio to marry. I know, Emma! The people can't see it, but we're like, ugh!
It is unbelievable. The mastermind of manipulator this man is mm-hmm. unfreaking believable to me.
Mm-hmm. Since Ronnie was so young and naive, she believed Phil when he said the shoes were his sister's.
Of course.
She never saw Annette, as Phil forbade her from coming into the studio. For years, Ronnie had no idea her boyfriend was married, even if the other girls did. Quote, "I had problems from the beginning with the thing with Phil," Nedra said. "Because Ronnie and I knew each other so well, I said, there's no way that this is who you're falling in love with. He looks nothing like the boys we've dated." It's true. Phil was already balding. And he's married. You cannot. But none of it mattered. Ronnie was completely in love. Even if she did suspect something was fishy, she wouldn't bring it up. she was equally in love with and scared of Phil. When she'd go out, she excused him lashing out in jealousy. She even excused him showing up to her plans and humiliating her in front of all her friends. Phil was her boyfriend and her boss. Quote, "For a girl singer in the 60s, your producer was your lifeline. If I said bye-bye to Phil, I would have been saying bye-bye to my career. If she protested, she'd be out of a job and wouldn't be able to support her family anymore."
I know that they were both young and Phil is like 6 years older than her, maybe five.
Mm-hmm.
But I feel like when one person is 18, 19 and the other person is like in their mid-20s, that's a big difference.
That you're in totally different places in your life. Phil was married with a career.
Yeah, that too.
And Ronnie's still living with her mom.
Yeah, and there was such a imbalance of power from the beginning.
Mm-hmm. Like she said, he was her boyfriend and her boss.
Yeah, and I could imagine how you don't want to fight with your boyfriend, even if something might be annoying because it might mess up your relationship with your boss, and your sister and cousin are also relating on that. Oh, this is like such a complicated situation, but I still cannot believe.
It's a yarn ball, Emma.
Yes, I cannot believe he got away with the shoe thing. I just cannot believe it. He got away with so much until he couldn't get away with something anymore. But we'll get there.
Ronnie had such a strong will and a strong spirit, but she was so in love with Phil that when he pulled the wool over her eyes, she didn't have a second thought about
it.
Yes. She just went along with anything he said to keep him happy, and because she did really love him.
I read that the men who usually want obedient women never choose women who are obedient from the beginning.
Mm-hmm.
They always choose someone with a career who they can then purposefully destroy to get to the point. And it is just so... I don't know anything about Phil Spector's first wife.
Not much is known about her. She was pretty quiet.
What it seemed like, she also was in a band. She also had some sort of career. So this is... I don't know.
It's a pattern of behavior.
It truly is. And for some reason, something about Phil must be so charming that he can get away with so much. Because that's what Ronnie says so often, that he would do these horrible things, but then he would be so nice and so loving. That must be so confusing. By 1965, Phil's obsessive behavior led him to effectively sabotage the Ronettes. He refused to release their music. He isolated Ronnie from her sister and cousin more and more, and turned down professional engagements for fear of Ronnie meeting other men. He even withheld Ronnie from participating in opening for the Beatles. Estella and Nedra were allowed to go, though. Even creating this discrepancy with in the band is so messed up. Phil was jealous of Ronnie's success and wanted to keep her a teenager forever. But she was in her 20s now and getting harder to control. Things slowed down even more through 1966, save for one thing, Phil's divorce. By 1967, the Ronettes disbanded, the same year Ronnie moved into Phil's mansion in California. With his marriage over and Ronnie as his live-in girlfriend, Phil's behavior got even more deranged. He completely cut her off from family and friends. The only person she saw anymore besides him was his secretary. When Ronnie confessed how homesick she was, Phil proposed to her to get her to stay. They were married on April 14th of 1968 in a small ceremony in Beverly Hills. Ronnie had high hopes of Phil no longer being as jealous now that she was his wife. They'd have lots of friends over, maybe even a family of their own. After all, they'd adopted their first child, a baby boy named Dante. Instead, things went from bad to worse. After marrying Phil, he slowly robbed Ronnie of all her freedom. First, he effectively relieved her of her motherly duties, hiring nurses, nannies, housekeepers, and cooks. Then renovations began on the Spector home. Phil had walls built all around the mansion. Then he had barbed wire added over the top. Then he had bars put up on the windows. In his office, he created a shrine, plastering photos of Ronnie all over the walls. Restrictive as the castle was, Phil didn't want to completely crush his object of affection just yet. She needed a reason to stay. So he'd take Ronnie out on trips every so often. He allowed her to record just one single in 1970, the George Harrison Penn Tandoori Chicken. Of course, Ronnie's output was completely dwarfed by Phil's. He experienced a renaissance through that year. He was producer of the Beatles' last released album, Let It Be, and was actually the producer of George Harrison's All Things Must Pass, John Lennon's Plastic Ono Band, and a single for Eric Clapton's new group Derek and the Dominoes. Once again, this show can't escape Eric Clapton.
I thought I was done.
He's everywhere.
He's everywhere.
This new career high wouldn't last long, though. Phil truly embarrassed himself by showing up to George's concert for Bangladesh too inebriated to work. His erratic behavior meant engineers did most of the producing. The quality of the final product was all over the place, and George cut ties. Whether or not Phil would release the little amount of music he allowed Ronnie to record depended on his mood. At home, Ronnie wasn't allowed to listen to rock and roll or read magazines anymore. The only music allowed in the house was classical. To cope with being kept from the one thing she loved most, she turned to binge drinking.
All she really had to do around the house was drink or watch TV or be with Phil. At the beginning, he started off so nice, like hiring all of this staff to help so Ronnie wouldn't be overwhelmed. Like, he had the guise of doing something really nice, and then he was going to fix up the house. But then he made it something so insidious.
Yes. He spiraled.
Ronnie wanted to be a mom, and he stripped her of that. And he quite literally imprisoned her in this house. The most famous incident that took place during Phil and Ronnie's marriage happened on Christmas Day 1970. It was immortalized in Roar's 2010 song Christmas Kids. You probably know it from TikTok.
This is really the TikTok episode.
Buckle up, people. Phil surprised Ronnie with 5-year-old adopted twins for Christmas.
This is
We were talking about this before. How do you do
this
that?
This is the wildest thing I've ever heard. It is beyond anything I've ever heard. We talked about this earlier because I know people who recently adopted children. Mm-hmm. And I know what an ordeal it was for them. And I think it is good. I think it is really good that there are so many rules in place. But the whole process took about a year. And I just wonder, I mean, Phil, he was a multi-billionaire probably at the time.
He was worth $50 million when he died. So he was probably worth $100 million at the height of his fame.
It's insane. So he probably bought these kids, quite literally.
He pulled some strings. I think he bribed people. Ronnie said, quote, "I couldn't handle it. It was way over my head. I had an adopted son already at home, and then to get 5.5-year-old twins," Phil adopted the twins named Lewis and Gary to trap Ronnie. Unsurprisingly, Phil's abuse extended to his children. He kept them locked in their rooms for days on end with only a bucket in the corner of the room as a toilet. Gary alleged later in his life that he was subject to sexual abuse from Phil's friends. With fewer projects on his plate, Phil's mental health declined further. He didn't allow Ronnie to go outside anymore, not even to swim in their pool. He brought in bodyguards and guard dogs. He didn't even let Ronnie be seen by male gardeners, butlers, or drivers. She was truly a prisoner in her own home. On the exceedingly rare occasion she was allowed to leave the house, Phil verbally abused her until she gave up asking to leave. She had to take a car with Phil's initials on it. In the passenger seat was a life-size blow-up doll made up to look like him. Basically, Ronnie couldn't run errands because Phil would find a way to publicly humiliate her. Her only escape were her AA meetings. Phil became infatuated with guns and bought many. On several occasions, he threatened Ronnie's life with them. To prove that he meant what he said, he did the most twisted thing yet, and this is the thing that really disturbed me. Like, yeah. Surprise, kids, we can laugh about that, but this is truly disturbing. Phil had a custom gold coffin made with a glass lid. When Ronnie threatened to leave, Phil threatened to put her in the coffin. Though Ronnie says he never put hands on her, she was still terrified of what he could do. All the while, he gaslit her, saying these extreme measures were to keep their family safe. According to him, it was to keep intruders out. For 5 years, Ronnie and her children endured a living hell, locked in a mansion prison under 24/7 surveillance, subject to psychological torture from Phil. For the whole last year of their marriage, Ronnie didn't speak. Quote, I didn't talk at all, because if I said anything, he'd yell at me, so why say anything? I cried every night I was married. In a truly baffling move, Phil tried to have Ronnie put in therapy for her drinking, but when she talked about the kind of environment she was living in, the therapist suggested Phil come to sessions too. He declined and canned the whole thing. Ronnie's wake-up call was watching him verbally abuse one of their dogs. In that moment, she realized he spoke to her the exact same way. On June 12, 1972, she told Phil once again that she was leaving. In response, he confiscated all her shoes so she couldn't run away from him. The one thing Phil couldn't break was Ronnie's fiery spirit. She told him she'd, quote, rip the wig right off his skinny ass. He'd begun wearing ridiculous wigs and toupees to hide his baldness. With the help of her mom, Ronnie escaped the mansion. She evaded the bodyguards and dogs, snuck through the gates, and ran all the way down to the street. Quote, barefoot and without a penny to my name, I'd never felt stronger in my life. But the fight wasn't over yet. Phil made sure to make the divorce proceedings hell. It broke Ronnie's heart to have to leave her children behind at the mansion. She had every intention of coming back for them. But Phil took full advantage of this. He dragged her through the mud in court, assassinating her character by bringing up her alcoholism. Him and his lawyers did everything they could to paint her as an unfit mother, and it worked. Phil got full custody of their three kids.
I wonder how the lawyers who ruled that feel now that we know about Phil Spector, what we know.
You know, if they can sleep at night is on them. They were probably paid pretty well.
Oh yeah, I was just thinking how we talked about Patty Boyd having such a hard time finding a lawyer to go up against Eric Clapton and George Harrison.
And Rita Coolidge just gave up wanting to fight Robert yes. Stigwood because she knew she couldn't.
Yes. And I feel like from all these men, Phil mm-hmm. is probably even mm-hmm. more powerful.
But after Ronnie and Phil's divorce was finalized in 1974, the mask he once wore so well slipped. The deranged behavior he once reserved for Ronnie was dealt out to others. See him firing a gun at John Lennon in the studio and holding the Ramones at gunpoint until they recorded Baby, I Love You.
This man was truly crazy.
Unhinged.
He's probably insane.
Unhinged. Yeah. The 1980s rendered the Wall of Sound obsolete, and Phil fell into obscurity. He had another set of twins with his new girlfriend. In 1978, Dante ran away from home and went to live with Ronnie. Also in 1978, Ronnie's beloved father, Louis, died of his alcoholism.
Ronnie spent the 1970s and 80s rebuilding her life and career. It was tough going. She still had a drinking problem to kick and legal issues for miles. Years of binge drinking had battered her voice. She lost custody of Dante a second time, and when she passed out drunk with a cigarette in her hand, she lit herself on fire. On the legal side of things, Phil had stolen all the rights to Ronette's music. It would take a marathon 10-year court case to regain the rights, though Ronnie would never be paid back the royalties she signed away. Phil had also blacklisted the Ronettes from the Rock and Roll Hall of Fame and many prominent venues. He even threatened to hire a hitman to kill Ronnie if she went on stage with Dick Clark in Las Vegas. Lucky for Ronnie, the 80s experienced a huge 1950s and early 1960s revival. Polka dots and pastels came back into fashion. Bands like the Stray Cats were releasing music. Billy Joel released Uptown Girl in the style of 60s pop music, and films like Back to the Future and Dirty Dancing took teen culture by storm. The latter, of course, features Be My Baby in the opening title sequence.
This is how I first discovered the Ronettes.
That's beautiful.
It was, gosh, a 30th anniversary screening of Dirty Dancing at a movie theater, and I went with my aunt and my mom.
Aww. Touring and making new music were just what she needed to heal from the damage Phil did to her. It was wonderful to reemerge from the shadows. She released two solo albums in the 80s, Siren and Unfinished Business. Thanks to collaborations with Alice Cooper, Bruce Springsteen, and Eddie Money, Ronnie was back to topping the charts. All became amazing, supportive friends to her, as did Joey Ramone.
As if I needed any more reasons to love Joey Ramone. It's the music, it's the photos of him with cats, and it's this.
Yes. Ronnie found love again as well. She had flings with Little Steve of Bruce Springsteen's E Street Band and David Bowie. She met her second husband, her manager, Johnny Greenfield. They got married in January of 1983. Ronnie said to People magazine in 2018, and quotes, "He's 15 years younger than me. That's why I married him, so he can take care of me when I get older." I love that. They would have two sons together and settle in Connecticut. Through the 1990s, Ronnie juggled being a touring musician and mom. In 1998, she lost her mom, Beatrice. Her last wish was to hear her daughter sing to her one last time. I mean, it is heartbreaking whenever someone dies, but that last wish is just so... I hope she got to hear her one last time.
She did. She That's did. Ronnie though. Sang to her at her deathbed.
That's beautiful. The Ronnie revival extended into the 2000s with her third solo album, The Last of the Rock Stars, and in the form of a young singer out of Manchester, England. This 23-year-old songstress did her long black hair up like Ronnie, wore pale lipstick and thick black eyeliner like Ronnie, wore dresses as tight as she could like Ronnie, and had just as powerful as a voice in just as little of a frame. Her name was Amy Winehouse. Her producer Mark Ronson interpolated Be My Baby for her breakout hit Back to Black. When the two met, Amy was so starstruck by Ronnie that she froze and burst into tears. Ronnie remembered Amy as being very shy and sweet, but her heavy drinking worried her as she was once in a similar place. Thinking of all the big names that have contributed to Ronnie's book over the years, Cher, Billy Joel, Keith Richards, there is no doubt if Amy were still here with us, she'd have contributed to her hero's book too. To pay her respect to a fellow bad girl, Ronnie herself recorded Back to Black and performed it regularly. And I dread On February 2nd in 2003, Phil Spector shot and killed actress Lana Clarkson in his mansion. To our surprise, Ronnie was shocked to hear what Phil had done. Erratic as he was, she couldn't fathom Phil doing something like this. He was first tried in 2007. It ended in a mistrial with a hung jury. He was tried again in 2008. One of his younger twins, Nicole, actually testified in defense of her father. According to CNN's coverage, she likened him to a, in quote, doting involved father and as wholesome as a family sitcom. His counsel tried to file appeals on three separate occasions. All were denied. Phil died in prison on January 16th in 2021. He left his $50 million fortune to his four surviving children, Louis, Gary, Dante, and Nicole.
I wanted to share this as a testament to just how wonderful of a person Ronnie was. Not only did she have the capacity to forgive Phil, but when he passed, she made a memorial post to her official Instagram, Ronnie the Bad Girl. I love the username. She said, quote, "When I was working with Phil Spector, watching him create in the recording studio, I knew I was working with the very best. He was in complete control, directing everyone. So much to love about those days. Meeting him and falling in love was like a fairy tale. The magical music we were able to make together was inspired by our love. I loved him madly and gave my heart and soul to him. As I said many times while he was alive, he was a brilliant producer, but a lousy husband. Unfortunately, Phil was not able to live and function outside of the recording studio. Darkness set in, many lives were damaged. I still smile whenever I hear the music we made together and always will. The music will be forever." Ronnie is a bigger woman than I for that. I, for one, yes, believe it was poetic justice for Phil to spend the rest of his life in prison after imprisoning his wife and kids. And I'm glad that Lana's family got justice.
Yes, it seems like his erratic behavior just spiraled out of control. It started with like little things of manipulation, and it just got wilder and wilder. And when you talked about him holding bands at gunpoint and just all of this, it almost seemed like this was the logic consequence out of his life. It seemed like his weird, unhinged behavior had to climax in some form or another. Lana, she didn't really know him. She was kind of uninvolved in the entire situation. She just went home with him after meeting him in a bar.
Ronnie's social media presence was just as vibrant as she was. She posted tributes to all her friends on their birthdays, including Amy's, saying, quote, "Thank you for making me believe that what I did mattered." Ronnie was also involved in the Me Too movement, posting, quote, "Every dog has its day," when disgraced film producer Harvey Weinstein was convicted of rape. In 2007, the blacklist on the Ronettes was finally lifted, and they were inducted in the Rock and Roll Hall of Fame. Keith Richards was the one to induct them. I love that. They were lifelong friends.
That's such a full circle moment.
Estelle Bennett passed of colon cancer on February 11th, 2009. In 2016, Ronnie released what would be her final solo album. It's called English Hearts, and it's a covers album of all her favorite British rock and roll songs. It's the only solo album of hers to make a Billboard chart, peaking at number 6 on the Heat Seekers Up and Coming Albums chart. In late 2021, Ronnie was diagnosed with cancer. In response, she released a revised version of her Be My Baby memoir. On January 12, 2022, Ronnie Spector passed away at home in Danbury, Connecticut, at the age of 78. As of this episode going up, Nedra Tally Ross is the last surviving member of the Ronettes. Quote, "When Ronnie died, I was putting makeup, lipstick, on in the bathroom and had a thought. This is the first time that I am putting my lipstick on alone. Because the reality is, I only saw the three of us all the time. We put our makeup on, we sat next to each other, we didn't even like smoke individually, because that many cigarettes, it would make the dressing room too smoky, so we would share a cigarette. Take a puff, put it back on the ashtray. In my memory, it's just the three of us. I could not breathe when I woke up the morning after Ronnie died. And then I remembered, We were baptized together, so you know, we'll be okay. And I won't need to bring anything up in heaven. Ronnie's incredible spirit, strength, and resilience inspires us to live just like Ronnie sang, or said. I don't do regrets, and I ain't bitter. Thanks for tuning into this episode of Unveiling the Legends, Dolls of the 60s and 70s. We hope you enjoyed our journey through the incredible survival story of Ronnie Spector.
As always, we're Emma.
And Abby.
Your hosts, and we're thrilled to have you with us on this groovy adventure. Remember, the spirit of these trailblazing ladies lives on in each one of us, inspiring us to embrace our individuality, creativity, and passion for change.
If you like what you heard, don't forget to subscribe, rate, and review the show on your favorite streaming platform. The button is around here somewhere. Your feedback means the world to us, and it helps others discover the magic of these legendary dolls.
As always, we'd like to thank special friend of the show, Michael Teggio, for the wonderful intro song. Until next time, keep the music loud, the fashion groovy, and the spirit of the 60s and 70s alive in your heart.
Peace,
love,
and rock and roll.